Illinois would become just the second state to cap co-payments for insulin at $100 a month. That's if lawmakers take up legislation from State Senator Andy Menar. Plus, four swastikas were found in recent weeks on the University of Illinois' Urbana campus. In the last 5 years, there's been more than a doubling of hate incidents. And in 2016, Russian hackers accessed voter registration files in Illinois. Today, the state still needs millions more dollars to improve the security of our election systems.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Coming up later this hour, the increase in hate incidents at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We'll also talk about what it's going to take to properly secure our state's election system. But first, when insulin was first discovered back in 1923, the inventors sold the patent to the University of Toronto for $1 because they wanted to make sure patients could afford it. Nearly 100 years later, that life-saving drug can be incredibly expensive, at least for Americans. In 2016, the average price was $450 a month, according to the Healthcare Cost Institute. Some insurance companies have launched more affordable monthly plans, in part because of public pressure. But states are hoping to take action as well. In just a minute, we'll speak with State Senator Andy Menar about a bill that would cap insulin copayments in Illinois at $100 a month. The only other state with a law like this is Colorado. And for more on that, we wanted to start with Emily McFly. She lives just outside Denver, and before that, she lived in Urbana, Illinois. Emily, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thanks for being here. Can you first explain what role insulin plays in your daily life?
Insulin is a huge part of my daily life. Really, it's my lifeline. I've depended on it for almost 28 years just to keep me alive.
So 28 years you've been taking it. You have, as I understand it, type 1 diabetes. Can you remind us about the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes?
Type 1 is typically diagnosed as a juvenile, not necessarily, but type 1 is an autoimmune disease. So whereas type 2 can be kind of self-induced by being obese, again, not necessarily, but a lot of times type 2 can be reversed by diet and exercise. My husband was able to reverse his type 2 by losing 100 pounds and got off of all of his medication. That's something that's never going to happen for me.
You can't exercise your way to health or anything like that.
No, my pancreas does not work.
All right. So how much does insulin cost you every month?
So I'm fortunate that with my husband's insurance, I spend $25 a month with my copay. The cap in Colorado is at $100 a month. So I'm fortunate that I pay less than that now, but it has not always been that case.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about that. So in the past, as I understand, you've had copays that are much higher than what you're paying now. And there are lots of medications when you have a disease like this to juggle in order to stay healthy. I got to imagine that's stressful, even though it's not necessarily expensive. I wonder, can you talk a little bit about how it feels to know that at least insulin isn't going to eat up such a huge part of your monthly bills?
I mean, it feels great knowing that, you know, I'm in a community that supports that. Moving to Colorado was not because of the insulin cap, but it was definitely a benefit. But it's just nice knowing that I don't have to budget that much money every month to be able to stay alive.
Yeah. You know, we so often hear about the healthcare bills that sort of get out of control for people. It's interesting to hear the perspective of somebody who hasn't had that, you know, who has sort of has the benefit of being able to, you know, I mean, do you feel a sense of freedom from that? And does that contrast with what you've experienced in the past, say when you were living in Illinois?
It does. I'm in my mid-30s now. When I was in my mid-20s, there were times that I was always reaching out for help with my medications, and not just insulin. I had an insurance plan at one point where I had to pay upfront for my prescriptions, and then my insurance would reimburse me. And for somebody in her mid-20s who didn't have a career, was insane. You know, I was living paycheck to paycheck anyway and trying to come up with, you know, hundreds of dollars a month just to keep myself alive. Obviously insulin is the one medication that I absolutely need. But besides diabetes, I do have other medical issues that, you know, I need to maintain with daily medications. Having the freedom now that I've got great insurance through my husband's job, and knowing that, you know, if for some reason he loses that, I'm still going to just have to cap out at $100 a month. Mm-hmm. Right now my insurance saves me, I think it's $740 a month. And that's on 3 vials of insulin.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're in Colorado now. You lived in Urbana until recently. I wonder, mm-hmm. what do you want Illinois state lawmakers, our governor, J.B. Pritzker, to know about your experience, especially since many of them probably have not experienced what you have?
I think that everybody should know that insulin is a human right. You know, it's something, there's so many miscommunications about type 1 and type 2. And that is a big issue for me when I hear people talking like, oh, well, if you just lose weight, you know, it'll go away. That's not the case for type 1s. And I feel that that's something that needs to be made a bigger deal, is the difference. And then just knowing that people are dying because they can't afford their medications. You know, I have friends that get sick because they can't afford their medications. Before I moved out here, I had a friend of mine from that I knew, and he reached out and he said, hey, by any chance, do you have any extra insulin? Like, I can't afford mine. And, you know, I had switched types of insulin. And so I was able to give him what I had left over, because I didn't want him to suffer from not being able to afford his.
That's Emily McFly. She's a resident of Colorado, living just outside Denver. Before that, she lived in Urbana. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
I'd like to welcome someone else to the conversation now. State Senator Andy Menar is a Democrat from Bunker Hill. He represents Illinois' 48th Senate District, and he's introduced legislation that would make Illinois the second state to cap insulin payments after Colorado, as we've just heard. Senator Menar, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
You've introduced a bill that would cap monthly insulin copayments at $100 a month. Illinois, as we said, would just be the second state to have this. Do you have a sense of how many people would be affected by this price cap?
You know, it's hard to tell. I think that's one thing that I've learned since this bill was introduced during the final days of the spring legislative session last May, is that insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies hold the data in their hands. We face that on any number of fronts when it comes to reforming the system that produces costs for individuals that I represent, that Emily just appropriately outlined. So it undoubtedly will be thousands, Brian. But I say this everywhere I go talking about this bill. If it just impacts the dozens of people in the 48th Senate District that I represent in a positive way, the people that called my office that said to me, hey, Senator, I have 2 children with juvenile diabetes, and I'm at a point, literally, as a working mother, not being able to pay for my house and the insulin that is necessary to keep my 2 children alive. I can't do both. If that helps out one person, this bill is worth it.
Now, and just to be clear, would your legislation only apply to people who currently have health insurance?
This legislation is drafted to be to the extent that we can positively impact this. That's what this bill does. So we are going to, we were proposing and hopefully implement a regulation on the cost of insulin to the extent that we can by state law. That's not going to cover everybody. I acknowledge that up front every time that we talk about this. And Representative Ghisardi, who is the House sponsor, he and I are working through how do we help everyone in this scenario, because obviously insulin is important whether you have insurance through an employer-sponsored plan or some other plan or no insurance at all, because the crisis is real for everyone regardless of those set of circumstances. But to the extent that we can regulate it through changing state law and implementing a new set of public policies, that's what this bill does. It will help thousands of people in the state if we can get it across the finish line to Governor Pritzker's desk, who has already indicated that if that happens, he will sign it into law.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone would disagree that, you know, people rationing a life-saving medicine is not a great idea. That's something that's terrible. I just wonder why is, you know, and it sounds like in between the lines of what you're saying, I'm hearing that there are some limitations in maybe what you think you can do with state law. So why is it that the price cap is the answer as opposed to some of the other ideas that might have been
out there? Well, I guess, you know, this is the extent that we can legally as a state regulate what Emily just described, which is a horrendous set of circumstances for individuals that have to go through this literally every day of their lives. I wish we could do more legally. Ultimately, it would be nice if the Trump administration and the Congress got together and addressed not just the price of insulin, but the price of life-saving prescription drugs that are just really soaking people across the country. I mean, my constituents, I'll give you my own example. My father, who is a diabetic, Brian, he spends out of pocket every month for prescriptions that he needs to stay alive about $1,000 a month. Ultimately, that is rests in the hands of the Congress and President Trump. But at the same time, this has reached a point with insulin specifically that we can do something about it for a lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people in Illinois. And that's what Senate Bill 667 is designed to do.
Mm-hmm. So mechanically, how does this work? Is there going to be a cap on what insulin companies, pharmaceutical companies can charge insurers? Or is it focused on what the insurance companies charge patients? Who's going to pay it?
Yeah, there's two pieces to the bill. The piece that gets the most attention is the cap of $100 per month. And that is going to be something that insurance companies are going to have to deal with. So it's important to note that the bill doesn't control the cost of insulin. The bill controls what copays are applied to it in an insurance plan. So that's something that's going to have to be worked out between insurance companies and pharmacy benefit managers and pharmaceutical companies, all of which have their hands in the till when it comes to driving prices through the roof. So this is a maximum that can be charged to the consumer. The other piece of the bill, which has not gotten a whole lot of attention but is equally as important, is we are directing the Attorney General of the state of Illinois as the legislative branch to investigate what is happening with prescription drug prices in the state. We are directing the Attorney General's office to open an investigation about how prices for insulin and other pharmaceuticals are just rising exponentially again and are soaking people that work every single day, not just in our state but across the country. So those are the two pieces of the bill: price cap on what copays can be charged in insurance and direction to the Attorney General to investigate why this is happening today in the state.
So Colorado already has this. I wonder, if this becomes law and an insurance company says, you know, well, too bad, we need to charge $200 a month, what can the state do in response under this plan?
Well, that would be a violation of state law, and that would be something that that the Attorney General would take up. I don't think that's going to happen, though, Brian. I think what's going to happen is what I've seen on the ground. We've traveled to any number of communities around the state over the last 6 to 8 weeks, and we're hearing stories from individuals like Emily, young people, teenagers who are coming to press conferences talking about what it means to know that they have this financial burden on them and their families for the rest of their lives, knowing that there is no backstop for them, knowing that pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies know the answer to the question, how much would you and I pay to stay alive? Or how much would you pay to keep your child alive? They know the answer to that question. The answer is anything.
Yeah.
Anything. Whatever it takes. So telling these stories around the state are very compelling, and that's what we're going to keep doing. If they violate the law, they're going to have to answer to the Attorney General.
So we've only got about a minute or so left here. We're going to be talking with U.S. Representative Congresswoman Lauren Underwood later this week. And you briefly mentioned earlier, you know, you want to see some federal action here. What specifically could the federal government do, in your view, or should they be doing to address this issue?
Well, Congresswoman Underwood and Senator Durbin have been leaders on this specific issue of insulin in the United States Congress. But step away just from insulin for a moment, Brian. The House Democrats in Congress have filed and are advancing a bill that would reform in a very good way how prescription drugs are priced and distributed, that supply chain that would drive prices down. That's the type of thing I would like to see Congress do. Kudos to Senator Durbin. Kudos to Congresswoman Underwood for leading that effort. Ultimately, our bill deals with just insulin, but we have to do so much more because this is a situation that can be replicated for millions of people across the country, literally everyone, actually, because there is just lack of reasonable regulation on the system today, and that results in corporate profits being more important than people's lives.
State Senator Andy Menar is a Democrat from Bunker Hill. He represents the 48th District. He's introduced legislation that would make Illinois the second state to cap insulin payments after Colorado. Senator, thanks for being with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break, the increase in hate incidents at the University of Illinois and what campus officials should do about it. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Across the country, reported acts of hate and discrimination on college campuses have multiplied in recent years. This rise is a familiar topic. We've talked about it on the show before. 313 cases of white supremacist propaganda were documented on college campuses during the last school year, compared to 165 incidents just 2 years earlier. That's according to the Anti-Defamation League. Earlier this month, Chancellor Robert Jones of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign sent an email notifying students about a swastika drawn in a campus building. There have been four of the Nazi symbols found on the Urbana campus over the past 2 weeks. Illinois Public Media's Lee Gaines has been following this story at the U of I and the increase in reported bias incidents at the state's flagship campus more broadly. She's here to tell us more. Also in our Urbana studios is Rabbi Ari Neve. He's a senior Jewish educator at the Cohen Center for Jewish Life at the U of I. And from Houston, Texas, Richard Baker. He's president of the American Association for Access, Equity, and Diversity, and he's the executive director for institutional equity at Rice University. He's got both a PhD in higher education and a law degree. His organization represents university employees across the country who are often on the front lines of cases like these. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lee, let's start with this most recent news. Can you tell us what happened at the U of I campus in just the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, so we learned that three drawn swastikas and one carved swastika were found on the campus. So two of those were in two different residence halls. One was on a study table in the agriculture department, and one was carved into the wall of a bathroom stall in the foreign languages building. We don't know when these swastikas appeared, when they were drawn or when they were carved. They were just discovered in the last couple weeks.
And these recent incidents are just the latest, right? The university calls these bias incidents. And you know, I just want to pause there because that's not a phrase that I use in everyday life, but I have heard of hate crimes. Can you talk about the difference between a bias incident and a hate
crime? Yeah, so there are some similarities. You know, bias-motivated incidents are defined as actions or expressions that are motivated, at least in part, by prejudice against or hostility toward a person or group because of their perceived disability or ability status, their ethnicity, their gender, their religion, their national origin, race, sexual orientation, etc. The main difference between the two is that a bias incident doesn't necessarily involve criminal activity. So, for example, someone might, post an offensive meme that would be considered a bias incident by the university, but it wouldn't necessarily rise to the level of a hate crime.
And so how much have these incidents, bias incidents, increased, according to your reporting?
It's pretty startling. Between 2013 and 2018, they have more than doubled. So there were 62 total reports in 2013 and 128 reports in the last year for which we have reports, which is the 2017-2018 school year. So that's a pretty significant increase.
And religious bias is a part of this increase, right?
Yeah, that was one of the really interesting findings in the data. So race and religion, there have been really significant upticks in the number of religious-only reported bias incidents. So in 2013, I believe there were about 5 such reports. And in 2018, they numbered 22. So that was pretty significant. There was also a significant increase in race and ethnicity bias-related incidents as well. And the other very interesting thing here, too, is that in the 2017-18 year, the university actually started breaking down religious bias by denomination. And so for that year, we saw there were 16 reported anti-Semitic incidents and 14 reported anti-Islamic incidents.
Rabbi Ari Neve is also with us. Rabbi Ari, I wonder, what have you heard from students in your own community? How are they feeling after these incidents in the last few weeks?
So thank you so much for the opportunity. Honestly, what we're hearing from the students here is that they're scared and they're disappointed and they're angry. The letter that came out from the chancellor, for which we are incredibly appreciative, it also mentioned there was a situation where there was a school-sponsored workshop through one of the departments here on campus that claimed to have been about Israel, and it instead promoted significant martyrdom. And this was part of the letter that the chancellor put out, and we applauded the letter, and we said that it was a really great step in the right direction, but there were a lot of other people in a lot of other communities and groups that really took significant umbrage and issue with it. And it's causing a lot of unfortunate and unnecessary division. So now, in addition to this fear from the rise in bias and incidents that Lee mentioned, there is this anger and this growing divide that we're seeing on campus that is just wholly unnecessary.
All right. I also want to bring in Richard Baker. Again, he's a director for institutional equity at Rice University and president of the American Association for Access, Equity, and Diversity. Richard, these numbers that we've heard about hate and bias incidents, I'm assuming Illinois is not the only state where we're seeing this pattern of increasing racial or religious hate incidents. Your organization represents university employees who are often the sort of first responders to these sorts of incidents. Are you hearing similar stories from them?
We are. Now, of course, as the president of AAAED, we did a study with our membership, which is a national organization. And in our study, we were able to contact 70 institutions across the country, and 68% of those schools reported bias incidents occurring on their campuses. 54% reported that hate speech, speech that offends, threatens, or insults groups based on race, color, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, disability, and other traits were occurring on their campuses. And hate crimes, which earlier there was a distinction made that bias incidents were not crimes, but actual crimes that are motivated by race, ethnicity, religion, et cetera. Almost 20% of the schools that we surveyed had experienced hate crime on their campuses. So this is not unique. This is happening across the country.
And Richard, I wonder, so these most recent incidents we've heard about at the U of I, at least, involve people finding drawings or carvings of swastikas. And while they may not rise to the level of a hate crime from a legal standpoint, what should universities be doing about this? Are there typically punishments for students?
Sure. So I think this is the challenge, and this is for people in the role that I'm in now. You know, is this something that qualifies as discrimination or harassment under your policy? And so for public institutions versus private, this could be a challenge. But there is no protection for defacing property. So you can actually take action against someone who's defaced property, regardless of whether or not the speech is considered protected. Or if someone is marching on your campus with a torch, that's something that you cannot do just because of the safety aspect of having the torch on campus. And so I think there's some practical responses that you could take for those sorts of incidents. But I would say that an example that was just provided, institutions, when they have these events, they should talk about them. They shouldn't ignore them. Putting out a statement to let the campus community know exactly where the institution stands is very important, especially for the people who feel that they've been subjected to hate or to bias, or that they're feeling unsafe because of someone's speech, whether protected or not, has targeted them. There are other things that schools could do. You mentioned bias incidents and having someone respond to them. Some schools are creating bias response teams, right? And so think about when incidents of sexual misconduct are reported, there's usually a follow-up by the institution. And so when you have incidents of bias occurring, you can have a group of professionals on campus or administrators on campus that respond to those reports. They could track where these incidents are occurring or what exactly is occurring, reach out and provide support to the individuals that feel subjected to the speech or the incident. Also engage those who were the instigator or the person that did the carving or made the comment, have a discussion with them regarding the impact of those comments. That doesn't necessarily stop the person from making the comment, but letting them know, especially if that is a protected speech, the impact of their comments. And then I think the most important part is monitoring it. And so creating a strong network of reporting so people feel they could report anonymously, et cetera, what's occurring on their campus so the university can respond appropriately.
You know, something you said a moment ago interested me. So you're talking about you can sort of the administrators can respond to this as a violation or crime even without the sort of racial or hate component if you're talking about fire safety or defacing property or something. But I wonder,
yes,
you know, I think we heard an example about a bathroom stall carving. I mean, are most people, that's a pretty private location by definition. Are most people caught who do these things or are they not caught? How are these things investigated?
You know, I can't speak to the likelihood of catching the individual. But if you do, you don't have to look at your anti-discrimination policies in order to process a complaint, especially if the concern is, does this person have the right to make such a speech? They do not have the right to deface property. They do not have the right to create an unsafe campus environment, especially the physical safety, a fire or something to that effect. So there are some practical things. Did they go through the process of posting that poster, right? That poster has to be approved in that area. Did they go through that process? So, you know, and your bias response team could be trained in doing that. And I think that if an institution has not created a plan for responding to these incidents, then they may be responding in an ineffective way, right? Because they're responding at the time instead of what is our plan when we receive these reports? How do we how to respond to them, including the public statement? That is, those are all things that should be a part of their response to these incidents. Last thing, one thing that I just want to mention, training the campus community on how to intervene when these incidents are occurring. So you have a speaker, you have someone is saying something that may be offensive to any member of the campus community. People should feel empowered, whether it's students, faculty, and staff, to mm-hmm. intervene, either to combat the speech with more speech or to delegate that to whether it's offices like mine,
right,
that respond to incidents of discrimination, harassment, or the campus police department, if you believe that they're doing something that may be in violation of some law, et cetera. So those are other ways to respond as well.
Okay. I want to ask Rabbi Ari, you've been listening here. What do you think about some of these ideas, about bias incidents versus hate crime? I mean, these are acts of hateful vandalism, however you categorize them. How do you feel about the way U of I is handling its response to these things as an institution?
Sure. So as I mentioned, the chancellor put out an email about this just about 2 weeks ago. And this is a step in the right direction. It needs to be followed, as Richard said, it needs to be followed with action. And I think those kinds of task forces and those kinds of committees and organizations set up within the university would be a huge step in the right direction with that. Something that we're noticing that I think is actually a great example of what those kinds of institutions could do is that, as I mentioned before, there's been a response to this email by a few organizations on campus that have been incredibly opposed to this email, to the chancellor's response. And what they're trying to do now in response to that is actually sort of try to identify anti-Semitism without consulting or speaking with the Jewish community or with most of the members of the Jewish community in doing so. They're actually trying to kind of define the hatred against us without us in that sense. And what that creates is so much more division and anger and fear on campus, because it in some ways delegitimizes that fear. It sort of gaslights members of our community, because what they're hearing from their peers, what they're hearing from these other student groups on campus, is that your fear, your anger, and your frustration doesn't rise to the level of what we think of as anti-Semitic acts or anti-Semitic remarks or statements. And in calling out the letter that the chancellor put out, they're saying, we get to define this term, and we are defining it in a very narrow scope, and members of the Jewish community who see the definition outside of that scope, their voice in this is not just that it doesn't matter, but that it's wrong. So I see potential for those kinds of committees or task forces that were mentioned before to do a lot of good in helping to really combat that kind of division and that kind of gaslighting, because it's so disappointing.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Rabbi. Lee, in the last minute or so we have here, I want to ask you, beyond the email, what has been the U of I's response? What's it said, and what's next?
So in this email, they did say that they are going to be instituting anti-Semitism training for all full-time housing staff, resident advisors, and multicultural advocates, and that the training will be in place by the end of this semester. They're also commissioning an external review of the university housing multicultural educational programs to help them identify and implement best practices based on leading national peers. So, I mean, a lot of this, you know, it's yet to be seen. I think what the rabbi brings up is important, that there are, you know, divisions on campus that exist, and this is kind of illustrated what's going on.
All right. That's all we have time for. I want to thank you all for joining us. We've been speaking with Lee Gaines, education reporter with Illinois Newsroom and Illinois Public Media. We've also spoken with Rabbi Ari Neve, a Jewish educator with the Cohen Center for Jewish Life on campus, and Richard Baker, president of the American Association for Access, Equity, and Diversity. Thanks you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. During the 2016 election, Russian hackers accessed personal information involving more than 70,000 voters here in Illinois. That information included names, addresses, partial Social Security numbers, birthdays, and driver's license numbers. Last week, lawmakers heard from state and local officials here in Illinois during a U.S. House Homeland Security Committee hearing. And with the Illinois primary 5 months away, election officials in our state are ramping up security efforts. But those improvements come with a multi-million dollar price tag, and the funding from the federal government might not be enough. To help us break this all down, we have Matt Dietrich on the line from Springfield. He's a spokesman with the Illinois State Board of Elections. Matt, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
So, Matt, we heard a little bit about it a moment ago, but can you catch us up? What do we definitively know about what happened to voter information here in Illinois during the 2016 election?
Well, what happened was in July of 2016, it was actually July 12, 2016, our IT staff here noticed that our system had ground to a crawl. Basically, everything had stopped functioning. And what they discovered was that there was an intruder that had broken into our system through our online voter application, and had been there since June 23rd. And we immediately shut down that system, took it offline for several days, notified the Attorney General. Once we found out that it was, in fact, an outside intruder, the Illinois Attorney General then brought in the FBI, and the FBI brought in the Department of Homeland Security. And so, anyway, shut down all of our systems here, with the FBI's help, things were down until we could determine that the intruder was no longer in our system and had not created a back door to come back in. It was a pretty big story at the time, and we ended up notifying 76,000 voters that their personal information may have been viewed in this episode, and we established a special hotline with the Illinois Attorney General's office where they could call in case they notice anything suspicious with their personal information. The primary fear at the time was identity theft.
Right.
And no one ever noticed any suspicious activity. No one ever called the AG's office. And in fact, on our website, if you can still go in and check, but all of the voters who their information may have been compromised were notified individually by mail. So I
want to fast forward to today, though, because
and
I understand you've been very careful in the past to say that, you know, this was not about voting systems in that 2016 hack, right? It's just voter information. But I wonder what are some of the ways that voting systems today, are still subject to interference?
Well, one thing that virtually here regarding the online voter registration database that was the target in 2016, virtually everything about the way we handle data with that particular database has changed and been enhanced. The way that we work with the local jurisdictions, because that voter registration database is updated every night when the 108 local election authorities in Illinois upload their changes to their registration. So we did, everything changed regarding that. When you get into talking about voting machines and the tabulators, for example, that you use in the polling place, it's really important that voters understand that that is an entirely distinct system, that those tabulators are never connected to the public-facing internet. So when we talk about cybersecurity, we're not talking mainly about voting. We're talking about all of the things that we have done here have had to do with protecting your personal information through your voter registration records.
And so I know you, the board has talked about, I think it's $175 million to replace those machines with more modern technology. But, I mean, there has already been some federal money spent, and I want to just take a minute to talk about, because I think when we think of hacking, humans are often the weakest point in any information security system. So can you talk a little bit about the previous federal money and the Cyber Navigator program, what that was used for?
In 2018, the spring of 2018, the federal government released $380 million to be used for assisting local voting authorities. And Illinois got $13.2 million from the feds. There was a 5% state match. So we ended up with roughly $14 million. And we are, to spend that money, we needed authority from the Illinois General Assembly. And in the budget that was passed in June of 2018, we were, one of the requirements that was placed on that money is that at least half of it has to go toward creation and funding of what is called the Illinois Cyber Navigator Program. What that is we hired, working with the Department of Innovation and Technology, which is the IT department for all of state government, working with them, we hired 9 cyber navigators. These are technicians who are assigned to geographic zones in the state, and they work with each county clerk or board of election within their jurisdiction. They go in, they do training of staff to alert them to things like phishing campaigns, how to avoid, I mean, something that simple is really a major way that hacks like you've heard about what has happened in Baltimore, what happened in Atlanta with city governments there.
Typically
come in just through phishing campaigns that come in to an employee's email. Someone clicks on a link and the malware gets in, and that's where it starts.
Yeah, we have a program here on campus called Securing the Human. So I'm afraid we need to kind of wrap it there. This is, I know there's this need that Illinois has identified for more money, but the House and Senate in Washington, obviously a Democratic House, Republican Senate, seem to be at loggerheads about exactly how much to spend, what to do with that money. So I'm sure we will have further conversations about this in the future. Matt Dietrich is a spokesman for the Illinois State Board of Elections. Matt, thanks for speaking with us.
Brian, thanks for having me. Call anytime.
Stepping through to win it for Chicago. Kerr's off and running, calling for it from Nagasato. She's going to get it. Sam Kerr back in behind the defense, and she scores to put Chicago on top.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and that was the National Women's Soccer League semifinal match from this past Sunday. The Chicago Red Stars beat the Portland Thorns 1-0, thanks to that goal by Sam Kerr, and advanced to the Chicago championship game. That game airs this Sunday afternoon, 2:30 Central Time. Since the league's first season back in 2013, 4 teams have won the National Women's Soccer League championship. The Chicago Red Stars, though, are not among them. Not yet, anyway. But they'll soon get their chance against the defending champion, North Carolina Courage. Sandra Herrera is a soccer writer and the co-host of Southside Trap, a Chicago Red Stars podcast. She joins me now. Sandra, welcome back to The 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
So last time you were on the show, it was right after the U.S. won the World Cup over the summer. And at that time, those players were returning to their pro teams to finish the season. Obviously, just getting to the finals is a success, but how would you say the Red Stars have done in general since we last spoke?
Well, since the Red Stars came back into their World Cup break, returned all their players back, and they went on a series of streaks. They lost 3 in a row and then ended out their season on an epic run to finish the regular season, going on a 5-game winning streak, heading into their semifinal, which I think ended up benefiting them. It worked in their favor. They kept that momentum going into the semifinal, and they finally broke through and are going to be able to compete for their championship.
So this summer, the U.S. national team became huge celebrities. Who are some of the players who represented the U.S. on that team who are playing for the Red Stars now?
You've got Tierna Davidson, who's playing center back currently for the Red Stars, along with Julie Ertz, who's also playing center back as well. And you have Morgan Brine, who's been a stalwart in the midfield for the Red Stars this season. And, of course, you have Alyssa Nair, who everybody probably knows is, you know, that famous highlight save where she saved the penalty kick in the semifinal against England. And she also came up huge again in the semifinal on Sunday for them.
Yeah. So the Red Stars, speaking of semifinals, in prior years, they lost in the semifinals in each of the last 4 years. Aside from the save you were just talking about, what got them over the hump this time?
Honestly, just all of the sort of all the chatter and all the narratives heading into this semifinal, there were a number of things surrounding the team. Of course, there was all of the chatter about having made it to multiple semifinals and not being able to punch you there. A lot of stuff flying around, rumors and stuff flying around their star striker, and just also storylines around their opponent as well. Just the fact that this was a team, the Portland Thorns, you know, they were a team that they were stuck and beaten since 2013. So there was a lot of stuff building up heading into this semifinal. But having all that really good cohesive play that they were playing over the last 5 to 6 weeks heading into the semi, I believe, really helped. Their back line, they solidified that by putting Julie Ertz and Tierna Davidson together, and Alyssa Nair having some really strong games, and really Danny Colaprico and Morgan Brine being able to connect well in the midfield sort of helped dominate the game for me personally, even though Sam Kerr got that brilliant goal, which was served up by Yuki Nagasato.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Sam Kerr. Let's talk about her. So she scored the only goal against Portland, had a great season, I think 18 goals, which broke her own league record. How important is she going to be in the final match?
You know, all eyes were on her for the semifinal, and I don't think that's going to be any different heading into this next match. You know, she's got all eyes on her for a reason. She's one of the most prolific players in the world right now, not just in this league, and there's a reason why there's all kinds of things surrounding her right now. But I really have to admire the way that she's sort of locked things down regarding all of this stuff. She is entirely focused on the task in front of her and said that she really wanted to focus on winning that semifinal, and that was the first box check for her. And she's speaking all of those same things heading into this semifinal as well, and really wants to get that championship. That's something that's eluded her in her NWSL career here.
Hmm. So the Red Stars are going to be playing against the defending champion, North Carolina Courage. Who's the favorite?
You know, it's hard to tell at this point. You know, I think there are people out there that really like the storyline around the Red Stars right now, but you have to take a look at the North Carolina Courage. They're a dominant team for a reason. They've made multiple semifinals and have, you know, won a number of various pieces of hardware, whether it's the League Shield or the NWSL Championship, and they've got an amazing, talented roster of their own. And this NWSL Championship final is taking place in North Carolina, so it's a bit of a home field advantage for them. So it's going to be a much different environment for the Red Stars heading into this match.
Can you describe the playing styles of the two teams? Are they very different?
You know what? I think for this championship final, these are the two best teams that we could have got in this NWSL final just because of their record. They are two teams that tend to match up very well against each other. Strong midfielders, strong defensive lines, and some prolific scorers up top to both, you know, score goals for either side. So it's going to be a good game for sure.
So earlier this summer, the World Cup helped generate more interest in women's soccer in general. Has that made a difference for the pro league here this year? Do you think the season's been different for the league?
In a sense, there have been a number of teams who, you know, have reported significant growth in terms of their general attendance. Physical general attendance at the games. But I don't want it to go unnoted that just the general excitement and enthusiasm behind a lot of these teams, even within their social media channels, you know, the impressions that they leave, whether it's on their Twitter pages or their Instagrams or their Facebooks and stuff like that, you know, the more global, larger audiences that they're now starting to reach besides just their local markets, I think is also very significant.
Sandra Herrera is a soccer writer and co-host of the Chicago Red Stars podcast, Southside Trap. The Red Stars again play the North Carolina Courage this Sunday at 2:30 Central on ESPN2. Sandra, thanks for talking to us again. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
We thought we'd go out on a Frank Sinatra's My Kind of Town. It's played often at Red Stars games.
My kind of razzmatazz.
And that is all the time we have for today. Our show is produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montecilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the show. And you can also find us on Facebook and podcast apps, anywhere else you like to listen to radio. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.